Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today is a South African-born playwright and the author of 13 books, including 5 crime novels, the courtroom drama Red Dust, which was made into a feature film, and the Orange Prize shortlisted Ice Road. She co-authored the play Guantanamo, Honour Bound to Defend Freedom, which was staged internationally. She was president of English Pen and is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Welcome to Gillian Slover, and thank you very much for joining me here. Gillian, you have an enormously impressive career, and I'm wondering if writing always seemed like the inevitable path that you'd follow. You grew up in Johannesburg with the sound of typewriters.
Yes, my mother was a journalist and a writer of nonfiction, and she had 3 children. She had 3 daughters, and therefore she used to have to work at night. And yeah, we'd wake up in the night and there would be the sound of the Olivetti, which I still have actually, her typewriter. And I guess she taught us that writing was a suitable job for a woman. My sister Sean is a screenwriter, and before she became a producer, my sister Robin was a script editor. So we all went into the trade.
Yeah. Now, you've written about that childhood in Every Secret Thing, which is the story of your family, and particularly your parents, Joe Slover and Ruth First, both huge figures in the anti-apartheid struggle. Now, your father, as we know, was a long-time leader of the South African Communist Party and a leading member of the ANC. Your mother, Ruth, was an activist and a journalist murdered by a parcel bomb by South African forces. Now, I know that you've written and spoken about the price paid by the children of that brave generation of activists.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was quite important for me at a certain point, and I think the point was after my mother's murder, to make sense of a childhood that was fairly traumatic because it was spent in Johannesburg, where my parents would have these wonderful parties and the uninvited guests would always be the police who would break in to try and find blacks and whites drinking together, which was illegal under the apartheid laws. And towards the end, it was particularly traumatic because my father had left the country and couldn't come back. And he, as far as I knew, had just disappeared. And my mother was in prison, held in solitary detention. And I guess when I came to England, there was a tremendous relief of not living under that kind of pressure. But after my mother was killed, I began to think that I needed to sort out for myself what this childhood had done to me and what it had taken away, but actually also what it had given to me. Mm. And although I think it's important to be clear about the costs suffered by the children of activists, I also think it's important to be clear to face the benefits of it. And certainly, I now feel when I go to South Africa, I have a stake in that country that was won by my parents, that I don't have what very many white people felt when apartheid was abolished, you know, a sense of guilt. Mm. I don't have to carry that, not because of what I did, but because of what my parents did. They gave me a place in society that I think is important to have. And also, they fueled my fiction as well, because I think a lot of the stuff I write about is about the impact of big politics on ordinary people.
Absolutely. Now, one of those books, of course, is Red Dust. And that happened after the hearing of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where you went to actually hear the killers of your mother there. But you were very careful in Red Dust to relocate that, weren't you?
I relocated it and I changed the story because I didn't want it to be about my story. I wanted it actually to be about a story of whether you can have truth and reconciliation in a country, whether it is possible to bury the past or to forgive the past. And Red Dust is really an examination of that. So it wasn't in that way about me. It was about how a country can turn from such a horrendous period and make itself anew. And what is it that you carry with when you go?
And what was it that you carried with you when you left South Africa and arrived here? You came here in 1964. It must have been, well, quite an experience for a 12-year-old child.
I carried with me for a very long time the memory of the landscape and the light and the sun and the weather. And that was quite fundamental, I think, to the way that you look at the world, is the way you think a landscape ought to be. It's taken me a long time to appreciate the beauty that is England. Mm. And also, I carried with me a kind of a relief that I didn't have to be in that maelstrom anymore, that I could make a life in a more ordinary life, I suppose. Because, of course, when we were in South Africa, not only were most of what my parents did illegal, it was also unusual for white people to be doing that. And therefore, I went to school with a set of school friends who absolutely could not understand my home life, you know, who couldn't understand. I mean, and I didn't even realize some of it. But for example, when my mother was imprisoned and it was in the newspapers, one of my friends said to me, "Is your mother a kleptomaniac?" Because the only thing she had ever heard a white woman being in prison for was stealing, compulsive stealing in a shop. You know, so it was a relief to come to England and not have that weight following me around.
And do you think that the idea that you'd kind of escape from that into something a lot more ordinary was perhaps behind going into a completely different genre, because you started writing detective stories?
Yes, well, I think it was partly that, but actually I think my childhood trained me to write detective stories, because most of the things that my parents were doing were illegal. They didn't talk to us about what was happening. If they wanted to talk to each other, they'd get up from the dinner table and they'd go into the garden and they'd chat. And yet it was quite clear to us that things were happening. And so I became a consummate eavesdropper. You know, I became a junior detective of trying to work out, is there danger? Is it okay? What's going on? Are they going to disappear? I think that was good training for writing detective novels.
Mm. You wrote a lot of detective novels.
I wrote 5 featuring the same detective, Kate Bear, yeah.
Who grew throughout the series?
Well, she grew partly because of the genre she grew, actually. When I started writing, I wanted to write a detective in like, yes, great ambitions we have, a Chandler-esque mode, but in the modern city that I inhabited rather than Chandler's city. And I also didn't want to have the lone male who gets beaten up 1 minute and the next is, you know, on his feet and doing what needs to be done. I wanted to write a human woman who had friends, who had a life. And I discovered throughout this why people don't do that. Because, of course, if you have a detective who has friends, who has a life, who has children in her life, it rather gets in the way of the plot. And so as it went on, first of all, I had to send her friends to America because, you know, she couldn't be drinking whiskey with them. It just didn't work. And then I killed off the boyfriend eventually to get rid of him.
You moved on then to Ice Road, which was an entirely different book set in Leningrad in the 30s. Why the shift and why that particular time and place?
Well, I wrote a few books in between that. And why Ice Road? I wrote Ice Road after the wall had come down. Now, I'm a child of communists. They were very different kind of communists. My father was very much straight down the line South African Communist Party. My mother, although she called herself a communist, was very critical of what happened in the Soviet Union. So I lived with that debate about the Soviet Union throughout my childhood and my adolescence. And after the wall came down, I thought I would be interested in exploring, you know, what actually happened in that country, what was going on. And I heard a radio program about Sergio Leone, the spaghetti western director, who I had loved his spaghetti westerns, you know, that the kind of film where a man, which is Clint Eastwood with a cheroot, goes into a town in the middle of nowhere in search of something about the past. And by the time he leaves, there are a few dead bodies and he's come to peace with the past. In fact, when I was writing Red Dust, I was thinking of that, except instead of Clint Eastwood going into this town, it was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission coming to terms with the past. But just before I wrote Ice Road, I heard a radio program about the fact that before Sergio Leone had died, he had wanted to make a film on the Siege of Leningrad, a siege that happened in the Second World War for 3 years. At the beginning of the siege, there were 3 million people in Leningrad, and at the end, there were only 2. 1 million, 1 in 3 people died. And Sergio Leone was going to make a film about it. And you can just imagine the kind of film he would have made. There'd be Shostakovich, you know, composing the Leningrads as the panzers move in on Leningrad. But I thought, okay, Red Dust was based on his kind of structure. Maybe that would be a good thing for me to write. And so I started researching it, and I researched it on the basis that I would read more about what happened in Leningrad. And if I was became more interested rather than less, maybe that would be a book for me. And the more I read, the more fascinated I became. I started off thinking I would write a book set in a siege about why people survive and why they don't. And I quickly realized that I had to go back in time, because the question why people survived in Leningrad was very much based on the fact that how could they have supported this monstrosity of a government that had impacted particularly badly on Leningrad? So I went back into the 30s and the Great Terror. And I suppose I was thinking about the arguments that my parents used to have about the Soviet Union. And so it sort of fueled my interest in doing it. Not that I wrote a piece of nonfiction. I mean, I do think fiction has to stand on its own, and the story has to be what carries people through, and not the idea of what you're trying to tell people. But it was a very good subject for me, because I had it in my past, but I was learning about it in my present.
And speaking of your present, going back to South Africa, which I know you do regularly, I wonder how you find it and how you've seen it progress since the end of apartheid.
Well, I lived in South Africa to write my family memoir in 1994, just after the first democratic election. And it was the best time ever to be in any country ever. There was such a feeling of hope and optimism about the future, and a sense that we have buried that awful past. And it was a real sense. I think since then, it's become clear how difficult it is to turn away from the past. And at this point, it hurts my heart, some of what's happening in South Africa. The rise in corruption that goes from the very top of government down into the locals just feels like corruption is awful for a society. But for me, I feel it's my family who's doing it, you know, because in a way I was brought up with the ANC as my family. So for me, it is really upsetting what is happening. But alongside that is, I think, the miracle of South Africa. Yes, it was partly in the Mandelas and his generation, but actually it resides in the people of South Africa, their generosity that they would move on. And that generosity still exists in the country. So I also have hope.
What about assimilation, being here and feeling British?
Taken me a very long time, actually. I've actually lived most of my life in England. As you can hear, I haven't completely dropped the accent. I must have a very stubborn ear. But it's taken me a long time not to feel a stranger. I think there are many phases when you move country. The first phase is you are on the outside looking in. You're the stranger. People don't quite get where you came from, and they don't quite understand your background. It was particularly true of me. When I first came to England, people didn't know a lot about South Africa. They heard about it as time went on because of anti-apartheid. But so the first phase is you're looking in. And the second phase is you begin to realize that you're kind of, this is your country and you're living there. And that phase involves, I think, feeling like a stranger in both countries. So that in England, I would feel like I was South African. And in South Africa, I would feel like I was England. And now it's got to the point, actually, where I feel myself to be England. Certainly, the city that I live in, London, is fundamentally changed from when I came. It is such a mixed society, people from everywhere jostling amongst each other. And the proportion of people who've moved country in the world is getting greater and greater. And so now I think I feel English. There are some bits of England I'll never get, because unless you go to primary school in a country, you don't quite get it. But in very many ways, I'm a British citizen and I am English.
I'd like to go back to your career and the next sort of shift in your writing, which was to do plays. And your first one was about Guantanamo.
Yes, that just came about because Nicholas Kent of the Tricycle asked me if I was interested in doing a verbatim play on Guantanamo. Now, Nick had done an enormous number of verbatim plays with Richard Norton Taylor, which were mostly based and taken from various inquiries. They did the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, they did the Scott inquiry. And he wanted to do something on Guantanamo when there was no inquiry. So he asked me if I was interested in trying to produce a verbatim play. And when he rang me up, he said, I think we need to do this fast. We need to do it. We're going to put it on in the theatre in 2 months' time. And I, who'd never done a verbatim play and never done a play, said, but what happens if I can't do it? And he said, well, if you can't do it, it just won't be very good, will it? And that sold me, because I believe that about writing about art is you have to be allowed to try, and sometimes things work better than others. And the things that don't work are the things that teach you as well. And so I tried, and it was absolutely fascinating. And I had the experience of that play with, along with the other two that I've done, is they've all been about subjects that I'm very interested but don't know enough about and am not sure what I think. And to have the great privilege of being able to go and ask people who are involved in a particular subject. In Guantanamo, it was we talked to politicians, we talked to lawyers, and we talked to the families of people who were incarcerated in Guantanamo. To be able to go and talk to them for a long time, I mean, my interviews last an hour and a half to 2 hours. And to really understand their different experiences, and then to shape it into a play, which is often the play is my journey through the subject, how I get to know a bit more about what I think without trying to force the audience to think what I think. It's just a wonderful thing to do.
And that play, of course, led on to the next one, The Riots.
Yes. And that again was, you know, I was in Scotland when the 2011 riots broke out. And I was watching the television, like very many people, thinking, what on earth is going on? This seems to come out of nowhere. And what do these people think that they're actually doing? And why are they continuing? And Nick rings me up and says, do you want to do a verbatim? It's got to be fast. And that again, that was wonderful. That, you know, that was there. We talked to politicians, we talked to police, we talked to people affected in the community, and we indirectly talked to people who are rioting. That was a gift to a play, because a riot is so dramatic that it sort of lends itself to being put on stage. Mm.
And, of course, to print, because that led to this wonderful book just published by Canongate, 10 Days.
Yes, in order to do these verbatim plays, I often interview about 50 people, but I can't get 50 characters on stage. So I learn an awful lot. I cannot get onto the play. And it was in the case of a riot. And when I was thinking about 10 days, I thought it was time for me to write a book that is really set in the England I know and in the London I know, which I haven't done. I mean, I did that for my detectives, but I haven't really done that since. I've written books outside of England, and I thought it was absolutely time. And I wanted to write a kind of a state of the nation book. I wanted to write about the city that I live in, where people get on the tube together and seem to be mixing, but live such completely different lives. And I also wanted to write about power and powerlessness and what politics is doing at the moment about that. And I just thought, a riot is a particularly good way of doing that because of its inherent drama that is in there. But this is not the 2011 riots. This is set sometime, it's now, but it's a little bit in the future, because I didn't want to write about politicians that could be identified. I wanted to write about politics more. So I have a politician, but you never know what party he belongs to, although I think you can probably guess. And, you know, so I had the gift of the play and the research that I had done. I knew, for example, what it felt like to be a riot policeman in the middle of a riot, because I had interviewed a riot policeman who was very generous with, you know, what the experience of being in that armor is, where people are actually in mayhem, people are trying to kill you, what it feels like. So it was a really good basis to explore this book.
In the real riot, there was never really a satisfactory answer from the police about the killing of Mark Duggan, which was the thing that sparked the whole thing off. And I wondered if you, through these interviews, got a sense of what really happened. Was there corruption involved? Why was the investigation held up in this way, do you think?
I think it's very difficult to tell, because the police are less than honest when it comes to what happened, and they tend to guard their own. I suspect what happened is what often happens when the police are caught up in killing somebody. It's just a total mess. You know, somebody does something wrong, something else happens that goes wrong, and they have guns or they have the ability. I mean, in this case, in 10 days, the dead person was not shot by armed police, but in fact died as a result of being held properly when they were trying to arrest him. I think that happens a lot. And actually, I was asked to do a verbatim play on deaths by police hand. And I started to do the research. I talked to a lot of families whose relatives had died, mainly being arrested. I never did the play because I just thought, I can't find a way to not make it so unrelentingly grim that nobody will want to see it. But I learned a lot about what happens in that situation. And in many cases, what happens when the police... when somebody dies in police presence, it's often because the police are scared and overreact, or they're pumped up and overreact, and they have so much power they can kill somebody.
The book takes up another policing issue, another very current issue, and that's undercover police officers and the second lives that they lead, often that police force themselves don't know about.
Yeah, I was affected by all the news that there has been, but I'm not going to talk about it a lot because it's such a crucial plot point.
Oh, it is very much so. But but I love the way that the book brings in all of these things that we're all observing around us every day. And the other thing that I particularly enjoyed was your device of the clock ticking and this kind of relentless beat that goes throughout the book, really driving the plot forward.
Yeah, well, it's called 10 Days and it's structured as 10 days that starts with somebody inadvertently killed by the police in a demonstration that turns into a riot and ends somewhere completely differently. And I do think the clock device was very helpful because, you know, when I first started writing, as we said, I wrote crime. And I haven't for a long time written it. And this one, I wanted to have a thriller element. I wanted to have the beat of a page turner going through. And so the clock came to me and seemed like a good device to get that moving.
You've got another play in the works at the moment. I spoke to Nicholas Kent yesterday. He says he's currently rehearsing your next work at the National Theatre here in London. And it starts with a very basic question, which is, what is Islamic State?
The question we set ourselves when we set out to write it, it's another verbatim, was why is it that kids from our society, from England, from Europe, are going to join this murderous organization, Islamic State? What is it about? And so, yes, it talks about the history of Islamic State, but it also, we had the privilege of going to Belgium. We went to Belgium because we couldn't find anybody in England who would talk to us, any families would talk to us about their kids and why they thought they went. But in Belgium, there was a women's organization of people, a support network of people whose kids had gone to Syria and ended up in Islamic State. And we went to talk to them about their children and about how it felt to be a mother of somebody who took this drastic, dangerous, murderous step. And I mean, it was a great privilege to talk to these women. They were absolutely wonderful. And what they gave us was the emotional spine of the play, of a way of getting an audience here to understand how people do this. And to also understand what is happening that is so crucial to us in our world, but feels alien, but it isn't really alien. And that's the great thing about verbatim plays, is because you can go and actually find out. You use people's real words and real worlds. You're able to give the audience a look in a way that sometimes fiction can't quite do it.
Do you think that there's a way in which this anger that's driving these children could be utilised in a beneficial way? And could we as citizens stop this madness?
I think we could help stopping this madness, but I think it's more complicated than one thinks. For example, in Belgium, it was quite clear to me, one of the major drivers is racism. Again, kids of Arab origin. And it's quite acute in Belgium. I don't think it's the same problem in England. I think we have a more successful integrated society. But I felt about the kids who have gone there in the same way I felt about the kids who went rioting, is you do that kind of thing when you don't have enough in your life. And also you do something as drastic, one, when you're young, because you're foolish and you don't think. And if what you do foolishly is to steal water in a riot and end up 6 months in prison, you're going to ruin your life. But if what you do is go to Syria and join Islamic State, then you're probably going to lose your life as well. So it's kids who don't think properly, but I think it's about alienation. And also, we need to give, you know, young people more hope that they can do something in their life, because, you know, quite a few of those Belgian young people, and I know it'll sound bizarre to most people, went to join Islamic State out of idealism. They were told, come and join us. We are making a new state. The caliphate is going to be a place where everybody is equal. And those kids are living in a place where they see everybody isn't equal, where, you know, in some sense, where capitalism has delivered great things to a small proportion of people, and a lot of people don't have a stake in that society. So I think it's a much wider problem than just a mad sect in Syria that we need to bomb out of existence. And I don't believe we can bomb them out of existence, actually. They're too substantial.
Do you think it's comparable, perhaps, to the Spanish Revolution in 36, when we saw people from Britain, many great writers and artists, join up on both sides?
I hate to think it's comparable, because I do think that there were some real politics there that were worth fighting for. And I don't think actually that anything the Islamic State does. Yes, but I think to those people, it might feel a bit like that. It might feel like you want to go somewhere where you can be different, where you can have a better life. I mean, what's ironic to us watching it is, you know, why would young girls go there? Because it's so repressive what happens to girls and women there. But I think it might be that, yes, people do want to build a society that they can believe in more. I think that's a deception, but I think that's what drives them there.
Gillian, from your earliest beginnings and your own family's experience, through your role at English Pen, you were the president of the Writers' Human Rights Organisation, through the verbatim plays that you've written and this latest book, you've observed the very darkest part of human nature. And I wonder, what makes you feel positive?
Because human beings are also wonderful, I think. And I think the fact that all these terrible things happen and yet people still struggle for a better life and for struggle for not just for a better life for themselves, but a better life for others. And I guess that does come back to my parents. I mean, my father was a lawyer. My mother was a journalist. They were white in South Africa. They could have had what is called, in inverted commas, the good life. It's very easy. You have servants. If you're a woman, you can work because somebody else take care of your kids. And they chose not to do that. They chose that it was more important to have justice in their society, to feel that it wasn't just you that are getting the goods of what that society delivers. And I think that is the great gift that my parents gave us, their children, is a sense that justice for all people is important. It's what drives my writing, but it's also what drives my sense of optimism, is that there are a lot of people like that in the world, and that, you know, people can learn to do something for others because it does something for themselves. You know, it wasn't that my parents were saints. When I wrote my family memoir, many people in South Africa who were my parents' friends thought that I shouldn't have said some of the things I said, because I also talked about the downside of what it was to be their children. But I think it's quite important to know that people who change the world, as my parents helped to change the world, are actually human. They also have problems. They can also be mean to their kids. You know, they can be mean to each other. And yet, they get something from banding with other people in order to change things for the better. They don't do it because of charity. They do it for themselves as well. And that's what gives me optimism.
Gillian, and you're certainly changing things for the better in your own work. Thank you so much. Booking for the play Another World by Gillian Slover is open now at the National Theatre here in London. And 10 Days, her latest book, has just been published internationally by Canongate. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to my producer Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. If you subscribe, then you'll never miss an episode. Next week, my guest is Garth Greenwell. He's the author of What Belongs to You, a book hailed as the great gay novel of our time. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.